You might have been familiar with my work on free software. This speech is not about that. This speech is about a way of misusing laws to make software development a dangerous activity. This is about what happens when patent law gets applied to the field of software. Now, it's not about patenting software. That's a very bad way, a misleading way to describe it, because it's not a matter of patenting individual programs. If it were, it would make no difference. It would be basically harmless. Instead, it's about patenting ideas. Every patent covers some idea. Software patents are patents that cover software ideas, ideas that you'd use in developing software. And that's what makes them a dangerous obstacle to all software development. Now, you may have heard people use a misleading term, quote, intellectual property, unquote. Now, this term, as you can see, is biased because it makes an assumption. Whatever it is you're talking about, the way to treat it is as a kind of property, which is one among many alternatives. So this term intellectual property prejudges the most basic question in whatever area you're dealing with. That's not conducive to clear and open-minded thinking. But there's an additional problem which has nothing to do with promoting any one opinion. It gets in the way of understanding even the facts. You see, the term intellectual property is a catch-all. It lumps together various completely disparate areas of law, such as copyrights and patents, which are completely different from copyrights. Every detail is different. And trademarks, which are even more different. And various other things more and less commonly encountered. That none of them has anything in common with any of the others. Their origins, historically, are completely separate. The laws were designed independently. They cover different areas of life and activities. And the public policy issues they raise are completely unrelated. So if you try to think about them by lumping them together, you're guaranteed to come to foolish conclusions, whatever they might be. There is literally no sensible or intelligent opinion you can have about, quote, intellectual property, unquote. So if you want to think clearly, don't lump them together. Think about copyrights, and then think about patents. Learn about copyright law, and separately learn about patent law. To give you some of the biggest differences between copyrights and patents, copyrights cover the details of expression of a work. Copyrights don't cover any ideas. It's illegal to consider copyright as covering any idea. But patents only cover ideas, the use of ideas. Copyrights happen automatically. Patents are issued by a patent office in response to an application that costs a lot of money. And it costs even more paying the lawyers to write the application than it costs to actually apply. And it takes typically some years for the application to get considered, even though patent offices typically do an extremely sloppy job of considering them. Copyrights last tremendously long. Nowadays, in some cases, they can last as long as 150 years, whereas patents last for 20 years, which is long enough that you can outlive them, but still quite long by the time scale of a field such as software. And think back, 20 years ago, the PC was a new thing. Imagine being constrained to develop software using only the ideas that were known in 1982. And copyrights cover copying. If you write a novel that turns out to be word for word the same as Gone with the Wind, but you can prove you never saw Gone with the Wind and that you wrote it on your own, That would be a defense to any accusation of copyright infringement. But a patent is an absolute monopoly on using an idea. And so even if you could prove that you had the idea on your own, it would be entirely irrelevant if the idea is patented by somebody else. So I hope you'll basically just forget about copyrights for the rest of this talk, because this talk is about patents, and you should never lump together copyrights and patents. It's about your understanding of these legal issues will be about like what would happen in your understanding of practical chemistry if you confused water and ethanol. When you hear people describe the patent system, they usually describe it from the point of view of somebody who's hoping to get a patent. What it would be like for you to get a patent, what it would be like for you to be walking down the street with a patent in your pocket so that every so often you could pull it out and point it at somebody and say, "Give me your money." There's a reason for this bias, which is that most of the people who will tell you about the patent system have a stake in it. So they want you to like it. There's another reason. The patent system is a lot like a lottery, because only a tiny fraction of patents actually bring any benefit to those who hold the patents. In fact, The Economist once compared it to a time-consuming lottery. And if you've seen ads for lotteries, they always invite you to think about winning. They don't invite you to think about losing, even though losing is far more likely. And it's the same with ads for the patent system. They always invite you to think about being the one who wins. To balance this bias, I'm going to describe the patent system from the point of view of its victims. That is, from the point of view of somebody who wants to develop software but is forced to contend with a system of software patents that might result in getting sued. So, what's the first thing you're going to do after you have an idea for what kind of program you're going to write? Well, the first thing you might want to do to try to deal with the patent system is find out what patents may cover the program you want to write. This is impossible, and the reason is that some of the patent applications that are pending are secret. Now, after a certain amount of time, they may get published, like 18 months, but that's plenty of time for you to write a program and even release it, not knowing that there's going to be a patent and you're going to get sued. Now, this is not just academic. In 1984, the Compress program was written. It was a program for data compression. And at the time, there was no patent on the LZW compression algorithm which it used. Then in 1985, the U.S. issued a patent on this algorithm, and over the next few years, those who distributed the Compress program started getting threats. So there was no way that the author of Compress could have realized he was likely to get sued. All he did was use an idea that he found in a journal, just like programmers had always done. He hadn't realized that you could no longer safely use ideas that you found in a journal. But let's forget about that problem. The issued patents are published by the patent office, so you can find the whole long list of them and see exactly what they say. Of course, you couldn't actually read that whole list because there are too many of them. In the U.S., there are hundreds of thousands of software patents, and there's no way you could keep track of what they're all about. So you'd have to try to search for the relevant ones. And some people say that that should be easy in these modern days of computers. You can search for keywords and so on. Well, that will work to a certain extent. You'll find some patents in the area. You won't necessarily find them all, however. For instance, there was a software patent which I think may have expired by now, on natural order recalculation in spreadsheets. This means basically that when you make certain cells depend on other cells, it always recalculates everything after the things it depends on, so that after one recalculation, everything is up to date. The first spreadsheets did their recalculation top down. So if you made a cell depend on a cell that was lower down and you had a few such steps, you had to recalculate several times to get the new values to propagate upward. You were supposed to have things depend on cells above them, you see. And then somebody realized, well, why don't I just do the recalculation? Everything gets recalculated after the things it depends on. Do it in the right order and they'll all be up to date. Well, this algorithm is known as topological sorting. And the first reference to it I could find was in 1963. Now, the patent covered several dozen different ways you could implement topological sorting. But you wouldn't have found this patent by searching for spreadsheets, because it didn't mention that word. You couldn't have found it through natural order or topological sort, because it didn't have any of those terms in it. In fact, it was described as a method of compiling formulas into object code. I think when I first saw it, I thought it was the wrong patent. But let's suppose that you've got a list of patents, so you want to see now what you're not allowed to do. You try studying these patents. Well, you'll discover it's very hard to understand them because they're written in tortuous legal language whose meaning is very hard to understand. In fact, things that patent offices say often don't mean what they seem to mean. Now, there was an Australian government study of the patent system in the 1980s. It concluded that aside from international pressure, there was no reason to have a patent system. It did no good for the public, and recommended abolishing it, if not for international pressure. And one of the things they cited was that engineers don't try reading patents to learn anything because it's too hard to understand them. They quoted one engineer saying, "I can't recognize my own inventions in patentees." And this is not just theoretical. Around 1990, a programmer named Paul Heckel sued Apple, claiming that HyperCard infringed a couple of his patents. When he first saw HyperCard, he didn't think it had anything to do with his quote, inventions, unquote. It didn't look similar. But his lawyer told him that you could read the patents as covering part of HyperCard, so he decided to then attack Apple. When I gave a speech about this at Stanford, he was in the audience, and he said, "That's not true. I just didn't understand the extent of my protection." And I said, "Yes, that's what I said." So in fact, you're going to have to spend a lot of time talking with lawyers to figure out what these patents prohibit you from doing. And ultimately, they're going to say something like this: well, if you do something in here, you're sure to lose. If you do something in here, there's a substantial chance of losing. And if you really want to be safe, stay out of this area. And by the way, there's a sizable element of chance in the outcome of any lawsuit. Now that you have a predictable terrain for doing business, what are you going to do? Well, there are three approaches that you might try, any of which is applicable in some cases. They are avoiding the patent, licensing the patent, or overturning it in court. So let me describe these three approaches and what makes them workable or unworkable. First, avoiding the patent. That means don't use the idea that the patent covers. Now, this can be easy or hard depending on what that idea is. In some cases, a feature is patented. Then you avoid the patent by not implementing that feature. Well, then it just matters How important is that feature? In some cases, you can live without it. A while ago, the users of the word processor Xywrite got a downgrade in the mail. The downgrade removed a feature which allowed you to predefine abbreviations, and then when you typed an abbreviation followed by a punctuation character, it would immediately replace itself by some expansion. So that way you could define the abbreviation for some long phrase, type the abbreviation, and then the long phrase would be in your document. Now, they wrote to me about this because they knew that the Emacs editor had a similar feature, and in fact it had it since the 70s. So this was interesting because it showed me that I had had at least one patentable idea in my life. I knew it was patentable because somebody else patented it afterward. Now, they had tried these various approaches. At first, they'd tried negotiating with the patent holder, who turned out not to negotiate in good faith. And then they looked at whether they could have a chance of overturning the patent. But what they decided to do was take out the feature. Well, you can live without this feature. If the word processor lacks only this feature, maybe people will still use it. But as various features start getting hit, eventually you end up with a program that people think is not very good. And then they're likely to reject it. Well, that's a rather narrow patent on a very specific feature. But what do you do with the British Telecom patent on traversing hyperlinks together with dial-up access? And traversing hyperlinks is absolutely essential to a major use of computers these days, and dial-up access is also essential. How do you do without this feature? Which, by the way, isn't even one feature. It's really just a combination of two, just arbitrarily juxtaposed. It's like saying having a patent on having a sofa and a television in the same room. And sometimes the idea that's patented will be so broad and basic that it's very hard, that it basically rules out an entire field. For instance, the idea of public key encryption, which was patented in the U.S. The patent expired in 1997, and until then, it largely blocked the use of public key encryption in the U.S. A number of programs that people started to develop got crushed and were never really available because the patent holders threatened them. Then one program got away, the program PGP, which initially was released as free software, and apparently the patent holders, by the time they got around to attacking, they realized they get too much bad publicity, so they imposed restrictions making it for non-commercial use only, which meant it couldn't catch on too much. So they greatly limited the use of public key encryption for a decade or more. There's no way around that patent. There was nothing else you could do like that. Sometimes a specific algorithm gets patented. For instance, there's a patent on an optimized version of the fast Fourier transform, which runs about twice as fast. So you can avoid that by using the ordinary FFT in your program. That part of your program will take twice as long. Now, maybe that doesn't matter. Maybe that's a small enough part of the program's running time that if it's twice as slow, you don't really notice. Or maybe that means your program won't run at all because it'll take twice real time to do its job. I mean, the effects vary. In some cases, you can find a better algorithm that may or may not do you any good. Because we couldn't use compress, in the GNU project, we started looking for some other algorithm for data compression. And somebody wrote to us saying he had one. He'd written a program, and he had decided to contribute it to us. So we were going to release it, And just by chance, I happened to see a copy of the New York Times, and it happened to have the weekly patent column in it. And I didn't see a copy of the Times more than once every few months. And so I looked at it, and it said that somebody had got a patent for, quote, inventing a new method of compressing data, unquote. So I figured I better take a look at this patent. I got a copy, and it turned out to cover the program that we were just a week away from releasing. So that program died before it was born. Later on, we did find another algorithm that was unpatented, and that became the program GZIP, which is now, in a sense, effectively the de facto standard for data compression. And as an algorithm to use in a program for data compression, it was fine. People who wanted to do data compression could use GZIP instead of compress. But the same patented LZW compression algorithm was also used in image formats, such as GIF format. And there, because the job that people wanted to do was not simply compress my data, but make an image that people can display with their software, it turned out to be very hard to switch over to a different algorithm. In fact, we haven't been able to do it in 10 years. Yes, people use the new GZIP algorithm to define another image format once people started getting threatened with lawsuits for using GIF files. But when we started saying to people, hey, stop using GIF files, switch over to this, people said, we can't switch. The browsers don't support the new format yet. And the browser developers said, well, we're not in a hurry about this. After all, nobody's using this file format. In effect, society had so much inertia in the use of that particular format that we have not been able to get people to switch. And so, essentially, community's use of GIF format is still pushing sites into using GIF format, with the result that they're vulnerable to these threats. Now, in fact, the situation is even more bizarre because there are actually two patents covering the LZW compression algorithm. The patent office couldn't even tell that they were issuing two patents on the same thing. They couldn't keep track. And there's a reason for this. It takes a while of study of these two patents to see that they really cover the same thing. If they were patents on some chemical process, it would be much easier because you could see what substances were being used, you know, what the inputs were, what the outputs were, you know, which physical actions are being taken. And no matter how they're described, you'd see what they were, and then you'd see that they were similar. But when something is purely mathematical, you can have various different ways to describe it, which are a lot more different. They're not superficially similar. You have to really understand them to see that they're talking about the same thing. And in the patent office, they don't have time. The U.S. patent office, as of a few years ago, was spending 17 hours on the average per patent, which is just not long enough to think carefully about them. So, of course, they make mistakes like that. In fact, I told you about that program that died before it was born. Well, that algorithm also has had two patents issued for it in the U.S. So apparently it's not that unusual. So avoiding the patents may be easy, may be impossible. It may be easy, but it makes your program useless. It varies depending on the situation. The second possibility is, and here's another point I should mention, that sometimes a company or a consortium can make a format or a protocol a de facto standard. And then, if that format or protocol is patented, that's a real disaster for you. There are even official standards that are restricted by patents. There was a big political uproar last September when the World Wide Web Consortium was proposing to start adopting standards that were covered by patents. And the community objected, and they reversed themselves. They went back to insisting that patents had to be freely implementable by anyone, that their standards had to be. free for anyone to implement. And that's an interesting victory. I think it's the first time any standards body has made that decision. It's normal for standards bodies to be willing to put something in a standard which in fact is restricted by patents, and people are not allowed to go ahead and implement it freely. And it would be to go to other standards bodies and call on them to change their rules. So the second possibility is, instead of avoiding the patent, to get a license for the patent. Now, this is not necessarily an option. The patent holder does not have to offer you a license. It's not required. 10 years ago, the League for Programming Freedom got a letter asking for help from somebody whose family business was making gambling machinery for casinos, and they used computers back then. And he received a threat from another company that said, "We have a patent, so you're not allowed to make these things. Shut down." Now, I looked at that patent. It covered having a number of computers on a network for playing games, such that each computer supported more than one game and allowed you to be playing more than one game at a time. You'll find that patent offices really think that there is something brilliant about doing more than one of anything. They don't realize that in computer science, that's the most obvious way to generalize anything. You did it once, now you can do it any number of times. You know, make a subroutine. They think that you do anything twice instead of once, and you've made a new invention, and that somehow means you're brilliant, and that nobody can possibly argue with your right to boss them around and restrict them. Anyway, he wasn't offered a license, and he had to shut down. He couldn't even afford, really, to go to court. I would say that particular patent was an obvious idea. It's possible a judge might have agreed. We'll never know, though, because he couldn't afford to go to court. Now, however, a lot of patent holders do offer licenses. They often charge a lot of money for that, though. The company licensing the natural order recalculation patent was demanding 5% of the gross sales of every spreadsheet in the U.S. And I'm told that was the cheap pre-lawsuit price. That if you actually made them sue you and they won, that they would demand more. Now, you might be able to afford that 5% for licensing this one patent. But what if you need to license 20 different patents to make a program? Well, then, all the money you take in has to go out to them. What if you have to license 21 patents? But people in business told me that, practically speaking, 2 or 3 of them would make any business unfeasible. But there is a situation where licensing patents is a very good solution, and that is if you're a multinational megacorporation. Because these companies own a lot of patents, and they cross-license with each other, and that way they escape most of the harm that the patent system does, and they only get the good. IBM published an article in Think magazine, I believe it was issue number 5 of 1990, on IBM's patent portfolio, which said that IBM got two kinds of benefit from its 9,000 U.S. patents. I believe the number is larger today. These were, first, collecting royalties, and second, getting access to the patents of others. And they said that latter benefit was an order of magnitude greater. So the benefit that IBM got from being allowed to use the ideas that were patented by others was 10 times the direct benefit IBM could get from licensing patents. Now, but what does this really mean? What is the benefit that IBM gets from this access to the patents of others? It's basically the benefit of being excused from the trouble that the patent system can cause you. When the patent system is like a lottery. what happens with any given patents could be nothing, could be a windfall for some patent holder and a disaster for everyone else. But IBM being so big, for them it averages out. They get to measure the average harm and good of the patent system. And for them, the trouble would have been 10 times the good. I say would have been because IBM, through cross-licensing, avoids experiencing that trouble. That trouble is only potential. It doesn't really happen to them. But when they measure it, when they measure the benefit of avoiding that trouble, they estimate it as 10 times the value of the money they collect from their patents. Now, this phenomenon of cross-licensing refutes a common myth, the myth of the starving genius, the myth that patents, quote, protect, unquote, the, quote, small inventor, unquote. Those terms are propaganda terms. You shouldn't use them. The scenario is like this. Suppose there's a brilliant designer of whatever who has spent years by himself starving in an attic designing a new wonderful kind of whatever and now wants to manufacture it. And isn't it a shame the big companies are going to go into competition with him, take away all the business, and he'll, quote, starve, unquote. Well, I have to point out that people in high-tech fields are not generally working on their own, and that ideas don't come in a vacuum, they're based on the work of others, and that these people have pretty good chances of getting a job if they need to these days. But, and so the scenario, the idea that this brilliant idea came from this one person working alone, and that he is unrealistic, and the idea that he is in danger of starving is unrealistic. But it is conceivable that somebody could have an idea, and this idea maybe together with 100 or 200 other ideas could be the basis of making some kind of product, and that big companies might want to compete with him. So let's see what happens if he tries to use a patent to stop them. He says, oh no, IBM, you can't compete with me. I've got this patent. And IBM says, well, let's see. Let's look at your product. Well, I've got this patent and this one and this one and this one and this one and this one, which parts of your product infringe. And if you think you can fight against all of them in court, I'll just go back and look for some more. So why don't you cross-license with me? And then this brilliant small inventor says, well, okay, I'll cross-license, and now he can go back and make these wonderful whatever it is, and so can IBM. IBM now gets access to his patent and gets the right to compete with him, which means that this patent didn't, quote, protect, unquote, him at all. The patent system doesn't really do that. The megacorporations avoid for the most part, the harm of the patent system. They see mainly the good side, and that's why they want to have software patents. They are the ones who will benefit from it. But if you are really a small inventor or work for a small company, well, the small company is not going to be able to do this. They try. The problem is that they can't get enough patents to do this. You see, any given patent is pointing in a certain direction. So if a small company has patents pointing there, there, and there, and somebody over there points a patent at them and says, give me your money, they're helpless because they've got patents pointing there, there, and there, but not there. IBM can do it because with these 9,000 patents, they're pointing everywhere. No matter where you are, there's an IBM patent pointing at you, probably. So IBM can always make you cross-license, almost always. But the small companies only occasionally can make someone cross-license. They'll say they want patents for defensive purposes, but they won't get enough to be able to defend themselves. Now, there are cases where even IBM can't make someone cross-license. And that is when there's a company whose sole business is taking a patent and squeezing money out of people. In fact, that's what the company that had the natural order recalculation patent was exactly such a company. Their sole business was to threaten to sue people and collect money from people who were really developing something. Now, since there are no patents on legal procedures, I guess the lawyers sort of understand what a pain it would be to have to deal with a patent system themselves. The result is that there's no way you can get a patent to make that company, Refac, cross-license with you. So they go around squeezing everyone. But I guess the companies like IBM figure that that's part of the price of doing business and they can live with it. So that's the possibility of licensing a patent, which may or may not be possible, and you may or may not be able to afford it. The third possibility is that of overturning the patent in court. Now, supposedly, in order to be patented, something has to be new, useful, and unobvious. That's the language used in the U.S. I think other countries have different language, which is pretty much equivalent to it. Of course, when the patent office gets into the game and they start interpreting new and unobvious, new turns out to mean we don't have it in our files, and unobvious tends to mean unobvious to somebody with an IQ of 50. Somebody who studies most of the software patents issued in the U.S., or at least he used to, I don't know if he can still keep up with them, said that 90% of them wouldn't pass the Crystal City test, which meant if the people in the patent office went outside to the newsstand and got some computer magazines, they would see that these ideas were already known. The patent office does things that are so obviously foolish that you wouldn't even have to know the state of the art to see that they're foolish. And this is not limited to software. I once saw the famous Harvard mouse patent, which was obtained after Harvard genetically engineered a strain of mouse with a cancer-causing gene. Well, the cancer-causing gene was already known, and it was inserted using known techniques into an already existing strain of mouse. And the patent they got covered inserting any cancer-causing gene into any kind of mammal using any method whatsoever. Now, you don't have to know anything about genetic engineering to realize that that's ridiculous. But I'm told that this overclaiming is normal practice, and that in the U.S. Patent Office has sometimes invited patent applicants to make their claims broader. Basically, make the claims broader until you think they're running into something else that's unambiguous prior art. See how much land grab in mental space you can get away with. When programmers look at a lot of software patents, they say, this is ridiculously obvious. Patent bureaucrats have all sorts of excuses to justify ignoring what programmers think. They say, oh, but you have to consider it in terms of the way things were 10 or 20 years ago. And then they've discovered that if they talk something to death, you can eventually lose your bearings. Anything can look unobvious if you tear it apart enough, analyze it enough. You simply lose all standard of obviousness, or at least lose the ability to justify any standard of obvious or unobvious. And then, of course, they describe the patent holders as brilliant inventors, all of them, and therefore we can't question their entitlement to power over what we can do. Now, if you go to a court, the judge is likely to be a little more stringent about the idea of what's obvious or not. But the problem is it costs millions of dollars to do that. I heard of one patent case, the defendant, I remember, was Qualcomm. And I believe the ruling ultimately was $13 million, of which most went to pay the lawyers on both sides. And there were a few million dollars left over for the plaintiff because they lost. To a large extent, the outcome, the question of the validity of a patent will depend on historical accidents, lots of historical accidents, such as precisely what was published when and which of those things somebody manages to find, which of them didn't get lost, the precise dates, and so on. So it's many historical accidents that determine whether the patent is valid. In fact, it's a weird thing. The British Telecom, following hyperlinks together with phone access patent, was applied for, I think, in 1975. Now, I think it was in 1974 that I developed the info package for the first time. And the info package allows you to traverse hyperlinks, and people did use telephones to dial up and access the system. So, in fact, I produced a piece of prior art for that patent. So that's a second patentable idea I've had in my life. But I don't think I have any proof of that. You know, I didn't think this was interesting enough to publish it. After all, the idea of following hyperlinks, I got that from a demo of Engelbart's editor. And he's the one who had an idea that was interesting to publish. I was just sort of doing, I called it poor man's hypertext because I had to implement it in the context of TECO. So it wasn't as powerful as his hypertext, but you know, it was at least useful for browsing documentation, which was all it was meant for. And as for there being dial-up access to the system, well, there was, but it didn't occur to me that the one had any particular thing to do with the other. You know, I wasn't going to try to publish a paper saying, oh, I implemented this poor man's hypertext, and guess what? There are dial-up lines on the computer, too. And I suspect there's no way to tell precisely what dates I implemented this. And was it published in any sense? Well, I mean, we invited guests to come in across the ARPANET and log in on our machine, so and they could have browsed documentation using info and seen the thing. And if they'd asked us, they would have found out that we had dial-up access. But as you can see, historical accident determines whether you've got prior art. Now, of course, there is a publication made by Engelbart about hypertext, which they're going to show. I don't think it says anything about having dial-ups on the computer, however. So whether it will suffice is not clear. So this is an option, the possibility of going to court to overturn the patent, but because of the expense, it's often out of the question, even if you can find solid prior art that ought to be sufficient to overturn the patent. And as a result, an invalid patent, a patent that nominally shouldn't have existed, but in fact lots and lots of them do, is a dangerous weapon. Somebody attacks you with an invalid patent, that can really cause a lot of trouble for you. And you might be able to bluff them away by showing them the prior art. Depends whether they can get scared off that way. They might think, well, yeah, you're just bluffing. We figure you can't really go to court. You can't afford it, so we'll sue you anyway. All of these three possibilities are things that sometimes you can manage to use, but often you can't. So you'll have to face patent after patent after patent, and each time you may be able to find one of these three possibilities you can use. And then there's another patent, and another, and another. It gets like crossing a minefield. You know, each step you take, each design decision, probably won't step on a patent. So you can take a few steps, and probably there won't be an explosion. But the chance that you'll get all the way through the minefield and develop the program you wanted to develop without ever stepping on a patent gets less and less as the program gets bigger. Now, people sometimes say to used to say to me, well, there are patents in other fields. Why should software be exempt? Note the bizarre assumption in there, that somehow we're all supposed to suffer through a patent system. You know, I tend to think, it's like saying, well, some people get cancer, why should you be exempt? As I see it, each person who doesn't get cancer is good. But there is behind that a less biased question, which is a good question, which is software different from other fields? Should patent policy be different in different fields? And if so, why? So let me address that question. Patents relate to different fields differently because in various fields, patents relate to products differently. On the one extreme, we have pharmaceuticals, where a given chemical formula would be patented. So that patent covers one and only one product. Some other product wouldn't be covered by the existing patent. If there is to be a patent for this new product, the patent holder would be whoever developed the new product. And that fits in with a naive idea of the patent system that we have, that if you're designing a new product, you are going to get, quote, the patent, unquote. The idea that there is one patent per product, that it covers the idea of that product. Well, in some fields, that's closer to being true. In other fields, it's farther from being true. Software is at the opposite extreme. And this is because software packages are very big, usually, and they use many different ideas in a new combination. If the program is new, you know, it's not just copied, then it's probably using a different combination of ideas combined, of course, with newly written code, because you can't just magically say the names of these ideas and have them work. You have to implement them all. And you have to implement them all in that combination. And the result is that that when you write a program, you're using lots of different ideas. Any one of them might be patented by somebody. A pair of them might be patented as a combination by somebody. There might be several different ways of describing one idea, which might be patented by various different people. So there are possibly thousands of things, thousands of points of vulnerability in your program, which might be patented by somebody else already. And this is why software patents tend to obstruct the progress of software, the work of software development. If it were one patent, one product, then these patents wouldn't obstruct the development of products. Because if you developed a new product, it wouldn't be patented by somebody else already. But when one product corresponds to many different ideas combined, it becomes very likely that your new product is going to be patented by somebody else already. And in fact, there is economic research now showing just how imposing a patent system on a field where there's incremental innovation can retard progress. You see, the advocates of software patents say, well, yes, there may be problems, but more important than any problems, the patents must promote innovation, and that's so important, it doesn't matter what problems you cause. Of course, they don't say that out loud because it's ridiculous, but implicitly they want you to believe that as long as it promotes progress, that outweighs any possible cost. But actually, there's no reason to believe that it does promote progress. We now have a model showing precisely how patents can retard progress, and the case where that model can fit describes the software field pretty well, incremental innovation. But why is software on that extreme of the spectrum? The reason is in software we're developing idealized mathematical objects. You can build a complicated castle and have it rest on a thin line and it'll stay up because it doesn't weigh anything. In other fields, people have to cope with the perversity of matter, of physical objects. And matter does what it's going to do. You can try to model it, and if the actual behavior doesn't fit your model, tough on you. Because the challenge is to make physical objects that really work. Now, if I want to put an if statement inside a while statement, I don't have to worry about whether the if statement will oscillate at a certain frequency and rub against the while statement and eventually they will fracture. I don't have to worry whether it will oscillate at a certain higher frequency and induce a signal in the value of some other variable. I don't have to worry about how much current that if statement will draw, whether it can dissipate the heat there inside that while statement, whether there will be a voltage drop across the while statement that will make the if statement not function. I don't have to worry that if I run this program in a salt water environment that the salt water might get in between the if statement and the while statement and cause corrosion. I don't have to worry when I refer to the value of a variable whether I'm exceeding the fan-out limit by referring to it too many times. I don't have to worry when I refer to the variable whether how much capacitance it has and whether there's been sufficient time to charge up the value. I don't have to worry when I write the program about how I'm going to physically assemble each copy and whether I can manage to get access to put that if statement inside the while statement. And I don't have to worry about how I'm going to gain access in case the if statement breaks to remove it and replace it with a new one. So many problems that we don't have to worry about in software, and that makes it fundamentally easier. It's fundamentally easier to write a program than to design a physical object that's going to work. Now, this might seem strange because you've probably heard people talking about how hard software is to design and how this is a big problem and how are we going to solve it. Well, they're not really talking about the same question I am. See, I'm comparing physical and software systems of the same complexity, the same number of parts, and I'm saying the software system is much easier to design than the physical system. But the intelligence of people in these various fields is the same. So what do we do when we're confronted with an easy field? We just push it farther. We push our abilities to the limit. If systems of the same size are easy, well, let's make systems 10 times as big. Then it'll be hard. And that's what we do. We make software systems far bigger in terms of number of parts than physical systems. Now, a physical system whose design has a million different pieces in it is a mega project. A computer program whose design has a million pieces in it, well, that's maybe 300,000 lines. A few people will write that in a couple of years. You know, that's not particularly a giant program. GNU Emacs now has several million pieces in its design, I think, because it has a million lines of code. And this was a project done with essentially no funding whatsoever, you know, mostly done by people in their spare time. So the result is, if you look at projects of the same size, physical and software, oh, there's another big saving. I almost forgot. If you've designed a physical product, the next thing you have to do is design the factory to make it. And to build this factory may cost millions or tens of millions, whereas to make copies of the program, you just have to type copy. And the same copy command will copy any program. You want copies on CD, fine. You burn a master CD and you send it off to a CD plant where they use the same equipment. It'll copy any contents on a CD. So you don't have to build a factory to make this product. So the tremendous simplification and tremendous reduction in costs of designing things. And the result is, we are, say, for an automobile company, if they're going to spend $50 million to build a factory, to build a new model of auto, you know, maybe if they can cope. They can hire some lawyers to cope with some patent license negotiations. They could even cope with a lawsuit if they wanted to. Designing a program of the same complexity might cost $50,000 or $100,000. By comparison, the cost of dealing with the patent system is crushing. Or actually designing a program with the same complexity as a mechanical design of an auto, that's probably a month's work. I mean, how many parts does an auto have? That is, if it's an auto that doesn't have computers in it. There are not that many parts, you see. Which is not to say that designing a good one is easy, but just that there are not that many different things in it. So the result is software really is different from other fields. Because we're working with mathematical stuff, designing something is far, far easier. And the result is that we regularly make systems that are much, much larger and do so with just a few people. And the result is that the patent system then, instead of being close to one product, one patent, we're in a system where one product involves many, many ideas that could be patented already. The best way to explain it by analogy is with symphonies. Because a symphony is also long and has many notes in it and probably uses many musical ideas. So imagine if the governments of Europe in the 1700s had decided they wanted to promote the progress of symphonic music by establishing a European musical patent office that would give patents for any kind of musical idea that you could state in words. And then imagine it's around 1800 and you're Beethoven and you want to write a symphony. Well, you're going to find that getting your symphony to be legal so that it doesn't infringe any patents is going to be harder than writing a good symphony. And when you'd complain about this, the patent holders would say, oh, Beethoven, you're just bitching because you have no ideas of your own. All you want to do is rip off our inventions. Well, Beethoven, as it happens, had a lot of new musical ideas, but he had to use a lot of existing musical ideas in order to make recognizable music, in order to make music that listeners could possibly like, that they could recognize as music. Nobody is so brilliant that he can reinvent music and make something that people want to listen to. Pierre Boulez said he would try to do that, and who listens to Pierre Boulez? And nobody is so brilliant he can reinvent all of computer science completely new. And if he did, he'd make something that the users would find so strange that they wouldn't want to use it. If you look at a word processor today, you'll find, I think, hundreds of different features. If you develop a nice, new, innovative word processor, that means there's some new ideas in it. But there must be hundreds of old ideas in it. If you're not allowed to use them, you can't make an innovative word processor. Because the work of software development is so big, the result is that we don't need any artificial scheme to incentivize new ideas. You just have people writing software and they'll have some new ideas. You know, you want to write a program, you want to make it good, so some ideas will come to you and some of them you'll see a way to use. So what used to happen, because I was in the software field before there were software patents, what used to happen was most of the developers would publish any new ideas that they thought were noteworthy, that they thought they might get any credit or respect for. Then the ideas that were too small, not impressive enough, then those they wouldn't publish because it would be silly. Now, the patent system is supposed to encourage disclosure of ideas. In fact, in the old days, nobody kept the ideas secret. They kept the code secret, it's true. So the code, after all, represented the bulk of the work. So they would typically keep the code secret and publish the ideas so that way the employees could get some credit and feel good. You know, they were allowed to publish papers. After software patents, they still kept the code secret. And they patented the ideas. So, in fact, disclosure has not been encouraged in any meaningful sense. The same things are kept secret now as were kept secret before. But the ideas, which used to be published so we could use them, now are likely to be patented and off limits for 20 years. What can a country do to change this? How should we change the policy to solve this problem? Well, one approach, there are two places you can attack it. One is at the place where patents are being applied for and issued in the patent office, and the other is when patents are being applied, that is, the question of what does a patent cover. Changing the criteria for issuing patents can be, or simply keeping a criteria, a good criterion for issuing patents, can work in a country which has not authorized software patents before. For instance, for the most part in Europe. Simply to reinforce the European Patent Office's rules, which say that software is not patentable, is a good solution for Europe. Europe is now considering a directive on software patents. Well, it may be the directive, I suppose, may be broader than that, but it's one of its important implications is for software patents. And simply by modifying this to say software ideas cannot be patented, that would keep the problem out of Europe for the most part, except for some countries that may have admitted the problem on their own. Unfortunately, one of them being the UK. Unfortunately for you. That approach won't work in the U.S., and the reason is that the U.S. already has large numbers of software patents, and any change in the criteria for issuing patents won't get rid of the existing ones. However, in fact, these patents are not officially labeled as software patents. I say software patents, but what do I really mean? I mean patents that might potentially apply to software, might potentially get you sued for writing software. But there's nothing that the patent office doesn't divide patents into software patents and other patents. So, in fact, any patent might conceivably get you sued for writing software if it could apply to some software. So, in the U.S., a solution would have to be done through changing the applicability, the scope of patents, saying that a pure software implementation running on general purpose computer hardware, which does not in itself infringe the patent, is not covered by any patent and you can't be sued for it. So that's the other kind of solution. But the first kind of solution, the solution that operates on what kinds of patents can be valid, is a good solution for Europe to use. Now, when the U.S. started having software patents, there was no political debate. In fact, nobody noticed. The software field, for the most part, didn't even notice. There was a Supreme Court decision in 1981 which considered a patent on a process for curing rubber. And the ruling was that the fact that the apparatus included a computer and a program as part of the process to cure the rubber did not make it unpatentable. Then the appeals court the next year, which considers all patent cases, reversed the quantifiers. And they said the fact that there is a computer and a program in this makes it patentable. And the fact that there's a computer and program in anything makes it patentable. This is why the U.S. started having business procedure patents, because the business procedures were carried out on a computer, and that made them patentable. So this ruling was made, and I think the natural order recalculation patent was one of the first, or might have been even the first. But throughout the 80s, we didn't know about this. It was around 1990 that programmers in the U.S. started to become aware that they were faced with a danger from software patents. And so I saw how the field worked before then and how it worked after. I saw no particular speed up in progress after 1990. So there was no political debate in the U.S., but in Europe there's been a big political debate. Several years ago, there was a push to amend the Munich Treaty that established the European Patent Office. It has a clause saying that software is not patentable. The push was to amend that, start allowing software patents. But the community took notice of this, and it was actually free software developers and free software users who took the lead. We're not the only ones threatened by software patents. All software developers are threatened by software patents, and even software users are threatened because, for instance, Paul Heckel, when Apple wasn't very scared of his threat, he threatened to start suing Apple customers. And that Apple found very scary. They figured they couldn't afford to have their customers being sued like that, even if they would ultimately win. So the users can get sued too, either as a way of attacking a developer or just as a way to squeeze money out of them on their own or cause mayhem to them on their own. All software developers and users are vulnerable, but it was the free software community in Europe that took the lead in organizing opposition. And in fact, twice now, the countries that govern the European Patent Office voted not to amend that treaty. Then the EU took a hand. And the directorates of the EU were divided on the issue. The one whose job is to promote software is against software patents, it seems, but they were not in charge of this issue. It's the open market directorate that's in charge, and that's led by somebody who is in favor of software patents. So they've basically disregarded public opinion that's been expressed to them, and they've proposed a directive to allow software patents. The French government has already said they're against it. People are working in various other governments in Europe to oppose software patents, and it's vital to start doing so here. According to Hartmut Pius, who is one of the leaders in the European struggle against software patents, a lot of the main impetus comes from the UK Patent Office, that the UK Patent Office is simply biased in favor of software patents. It had a public consultation, and most of the responses were opposed to software patents. They then wrote a report saying that people seem to be content with them, completely disregarding the answers. You see, the free software community said, please send answers to them, and please send your answers to us too, and we'll publish them. So they published these answers, which were opposed generally. You'd never guess that from the report that the UK Patent Office published. They use a term which they call technical effect, and this is a term that can stretch tremendously. You're supposed to think it means that a program idea would only be patentable if it relates closely to specific physical activities. Well, if that's the interpretation, it would mostly solve the problem. If the only software ideas that could be patented were those that really did relate to a particular a specific physical result that you might have patented if it didn't use a program, that would be okay. The problem is you can stretch that term. You can describe the result you get by running any program as a physical result. And how is this physical result different from every other? Well, it's the result of this computation. The result is that the UK Patent Office is proposing something that looks like it leads to mostly solving the problem and really gives carte blanche for patenting almost anything. The people in the same ministry are also involved in a copyright issue, which really has nothing to do with software patents except that it's being handled by the same people. It's the question of interpreting the recent EU copyright directive, something, a horrible law like the Digital Millennium Copyright Act in the U.S., but there is some latitude for countries to decide how to implement it. And the UK is proposing the most draconian possible way of implementing this directive. And you could greatly reduce the harm that it does by implementing it properly. The UK wants to maximize the tyrannical effect of this directive. So it seems that there's a certain group, I think it's the Department of Trade and Industry, who need to be reined in, it's necessary to put a check on their activities, stop their creating new forms of power. Software patents tie up every software developer and every computer user in a new form of bureaucracy. If the businesses that use computers realized how much trouble this could cause for them, they would be up in arms, and I'm sure they could stop it. Business doesn't like being tied up in bureaucracy. Sometimes, of course, it serves an important purpose. There are some areas where we wish the UK government did a more careful job of tying certain businesses up in bureaucracy, like when it involves moving animals around. But in some cases, when it doesn't serve any purpose except to create artificial monopolies so that somebody can interfere with software development, squeeze money out of developers and users, then we should reject it. We need to make management aware of what software patents will do to them. Get their support in fighting against software patents in Europe. The battle is not over and still can be won.
Do you actually think that it would be a good idea, practical or otherwise, to actually get rid of patents entirely?
I don't know. I'm not an expert on fields like automobile engineering or chemical engineering, and I don't know whether patents do promote progress in those fields. I limit myself to saying that in the software field, they're a disaster.
Much of your argument as to why software is special from a patent point of view seems to stem from the fact that software by its very nature is made up of a large number of essentially trivial incremental changes. Every so often...
I didn't quite say that. That's similar to what I said, but not exactly what I said.
Okay. approximately, you said that.
It's sometimes partly the same and partly different, right. So just keep that in mind.
Sometimes one comes across... bits of software or indeed algorithms which are so fiendishly cunning and complex that you think, my God, that was clever.
I agree. I didn't say that never happened.
And I think that in terms of the advancement of the field of software, they are similar to some of the advancements in other fields.
So
that
what?
Get,
but you see, that's not the point.
The argument that you seem to be making is
that... has nothing
that
to do with that. I didn't say all software patents
are
obvious.
Am I allowed to finish my question, or were you...
you're already misrepresenting it, so...
If the software laws were amended so that only truly significant changes were...
a disaster. It would be almost the same disaster as we have now. You know, people who, for no rational reason, want to believe in the patent system, they always go to that particular opinion. That's their fallback. You know, surely if the patent system were carried out in the right way, then it would be beneficial. Why in the world should we think it would be beneficial? You know, it might do less harm because it'd be if there were fewer patents. You know, some of the patents that we now have to deal with wouldn't be there, and some of them would. So some of the danger wouldn't be there, and some of it would. You know, I've seen, you know, there are ideas that strike me as brilliant, too. I'm not saying that all software ideas are trivial. I'm not saying that software patents are bad because the patent office is incompetent, even though it is incompetent.
Yeah.
The point is that software patents are bad because they restrict the programs you can write. There's nothing beneficial to society in restricting the programs you can write, and it causes a lot of trouble.
But patents in, for instance, design of automotive parts or design of engineering systems restrict the systems that
they
you can build.
They restrict what kinds of parts large auto factories can make. But because they're only restricting these large and otherwise expensive factories, they're not... impose their foot doesn't come down on such a big piece of society. So it's just an industrial regulation. And so I don't think one should take offense at the idea of an industrial regulation. It may be harmful, it may be beneficial, I don't know. You shouldn't assume that it is beneficial in automobiles, but I won't assume it's harmful in automobiles either. I don't know. But the point is that it might be beneficial in automobiles, and if the automobile companies aren't clamoring to get rid of it, no one else has a reason to complain. It only restricts automobile manufacturers. So, but programming is something that you don't need a gigantic investment to do. You just have to learn that skill, and you can write. And then running it, well, how many PCs are there in the world now? 500 million or so? So that's 500 million people who can be restricted in what they can run. So what you're talking about is a much bigger restriction on society. In addition, incremental innovation means that you tend to retard progress. And innovation, because our products are have so many more things in them, our innovation is going to be more incremental, even if we're no smarter than automobile engineers.
On the subject of trying to determine the difference between the field of software and the field of, in your example, automotive production, have you considered, and would it be sensible to consider some other fields which have similar but in a sense also different problems with patents, for instance genomics, which has similar problems with intellectual land grab?
There are problems in the patent system that probably should be fixed for all fields, but I don't think there's much similarity between genetic engineering and software design. On the one hand, you've got something where you can just write something and it's correct. And if you thought correctly, it works. And on the other hand, it's tremendously hard to understand what the effects in genetic engineering. It's tremendously hard to understand the effects of whatever it is you've done. So those fields are not similar at all. You know, we're just the very beginning of being able to design a chemical substance that will do something. All we really know how to do at this stage is take a gene which does something in this organism and put it in somewhere into that organism, and it turns out even the effects of that are not easy to determine.
But one of the differences but similarities with genomics is, in fact, that the writing has already been done for you by several billion years of evolution.
Well, that's actually the difference, because software hasn't been written by billions of years of evolution.
I had a passing thought in the midst of all this whilst you were describing the various ways that patents are used as a blunt weapon to bludgeon people into submission, basically. And it occurred to me that is there any scope potentially in the law for somebody to take a case where they go, okay, this patent is, not only am I going to overturn it, but I'm going to come back afterwards and prosecute the person who took out the patent for
I don't know if legally there... I don't think there's a legally a basis for doing that. But the thing is, please don't think of solutions like that. It's a terrible, the point is, it's a mistake to think that that's a good way to solve the